Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press. Our small press publishes books we want to see in the world, including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison of New World Witchery Podcast, and Verona Green, my latest book. Find out more about us and purchase these and other titles at thousandvoltpress.com. Erin McGowan published her first novel in 2012 and has followed it up with many others in the crime fiction genre and also in women's fiction, writing as Eva Woods. She has had 4 radio plays broadcast on the BBC, and her thrillers, What You Did and The Other Wife, were both #1 bestsellers. She ran the UK's first MA in crime writing for 5 years and regularly teaches and talks about writing. Her first nonfiction project, the true crime book, The Vanishing Triangle, was released in 2021. She also writes scripts and has several projects in development for TV. And I got to read her new book, Let Me In. And Claire McGowan, welcome to Witchlit.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for coming on.
Great. Nice to speak to you.
Yeah. So I cannot wait to talk more about the book and the witchiness and all of those good things. But our first question for everybody on the show is, you know, in this age of so many different ways to communicate and instantaneousness, why write? Why still write books?
Oh, that's a great question. I do wonder about this quite often. I have this sort of ongoing worry that people don't read anymore. Like I was out on holiday last week and I looked around the beach and nobody was reading except for me. I always find that really worrying. And I do write a little bit for TV, but I've just always loved books so much my whole life and read so many books that I think that's just naturally what comes out. And I think you can't replicate the experience. So like my partner is a big games person. He loves playing games. He made games for years and I have never played a game in my life, a computer game. And I love the sort of the passiveness of reading, just being led through a story by the hand. I really love that. I think that's why.
Where did you always want to be a writer, or was that something that came later for you?
Always, yeah, definitely. As soon as I learned to write, really, when I was probably 7 or 8. Yeah, I started writing my first book when I was 9. Didn't get very far with it, but the intention was there.
Yeah, I was like 9 is precocious to get a publishing contract, I would think.
Well, I remember that there was this girl that did get something published that I'd heard of in the news when she was about 9 or so, and I was incredibly jealous.
Wow. Yeah, that's impressive. So what did that road to getting published look like for you?
I think I sort of convinced myself that it was going to be incredibly difficult, and I'd sort of given up really before I tried, I think. I didn't grow up in a very artsy background. I grew up in the countryside in Ireland. I'd never met anyone that worked in the arts in any capacity, so didn't really get that was something people could do. So I went off, I did English at university, but we didn't have any kind of creative writing component. Got a normal job for a few years, but it was always just still there, the burning desire to write a book. And I used to start books and then not know how to finish them. So lots of abandoned bits of things, lots of different ideas. And then when I was in my mid-20s, I thought I better actually give this a go and try and finish something before I can say that I failed. Should actually try, probably. So I spent a few years, probably 2 or 3 years, writing a book and just really agonizing, had no idea what I was doing. I probably wrote 250,000 words, I'd say, and then deleted more than half of that. So just no idea what I was doing. But eventually I did finish it and send it out. Very slow process as well. I didn't know at the time that it was okay to send it to multiple agents at once. So I just sent it to one at a time, and sometimes people have it for 6 months. So a lot of time went by. And in the meantime, I just wrote something else. And then I ended up entering that into a competition. Some agents got in touch with me, and then I sold that book and published it, and still have never published the first one. Although I would quite like to go back to it because I think it's probably not that bad. But if I could give it a good overhaul.
Now that you've got more under your belt, yeah.
Absolutely. Now I know how to do it. I did not know how to do it at all at the time, but I know now.
Yeah, I think about the actual process of writing a novel And I understand, like, and you've probably had this experience that when you tell people you're a writer, it's like suddenly you turn into a magical unicorn because it's so out of people's realm of reality that you could sit down and write that many words. Like, I think we all think about like writing papers in school or something and and equate it with that. And then when you actually sit down to do it yourself, it is daunting, but there's also like, I don't know, like for me, it just, once you actually put your mind to it and do it and you write, I don't outline, I just write into the dark. And it just kind of happens by magic. And I hate to tell people that because I'm like, I don't know how to tell you how to write a novel. Like there are steps and there are, you know, structures and all this thing you could learn, but the actual sitting down and doing it is just kind of this thing that happens that you make happen.
It's a huge, I think it's just a huge mental leap from I'm going to write a novel too. I'm going to just type. I think of it as just typing now. So I'm going to type 1,000 words. And I'm going to just do that every day for 3 months and then I'll have something.
Yeah.
You put it in those terms, actually, it sounds fairly straightforward. So I also don't, I'm not really a planner either. So I just like to, as you say, into the dark, I just like to see where it leads me. I really enjoy that stage, actually.
Well, I feel like I enjoy the surprises that happen, although sometimes I can get derailed too, but I enjoy the surprises.
I enjoy sort of finding out. Usually don't know what happens at the end or who done it.
Drew you, I mean, there is this really long tradition of British and Irish crime fiction and mystery and all of that. So I'm curious what drew you to that? Or was that something you were a big reader of, or was just when you sat down, that's what came out?
I think it was sort of accidental. My first book that was published was about a murder, but it was more sort of about the aftermath of a murder and the effects of it. So I didn't intend it as a thriller. And if I'd known it was going to be a thriller, I would probably do it quite differently now. So just kind of stumbled into it, really. But I did used to read a lot of Agatha Christie as a child. Like I was kind of obsessed with it. So I could read one of those in a few hours usually.
Yeah. I too had a childhood obsession with Agatha Christie. I think it was just, I mean, they're like, you can't walk into, I'm here in the States and I'm sure it's true anywhere that English is spoken, is you walk into a used bookstore and there's a whole shelf, two shelves of Agatha Christie novels. There's just so many out in the world. So they're easy to get your hands on.
I definitely haven't read all of them, but there's just so many.
I'm sure there is a completist out there, but I'm not one either. I haven't read everything.
No, I think kind of her later books also weren't really as good. I think there's a definite drop off once you get to the 1960s.
So your newest book, the one that I had the pleasure of reading and staying up too late to finish, is it's kind of, I always describe these as whydunits instead of whodunits, because we think we know from the beginning what the story is, and then we find out that's not the story at all. But why involve this kind of element of witchcraft in this particular book? Like, what drew you to this particular story?
I think I'd sort of become interested in the tarot and things like that during lockdown, and I guess it just sort of comes out of my own interest in it and just spilled in. But I never wanted to write, and I probably don't ever want to write anything where there's actual supernatural things going on. I think it's much more interesting if everything has an explanation, but it's very sort of dark and spooky.
I guess for listeners who, you know, aren't familiar with work or haven't read this book, do you want to do like a brief spoiler-free synopsis for folks so they'll know what we're talking about?
Yeah, so it's about a young couple who leave London just after the pandemic, and the wife is a doctor and she's incredibly burnt out from working during COVID. Her husband is a journalist. He's kind of lost his job, down on his luck, and you find out why that is eventually. But he says he's bought them a house in Cornwall, which is in the southwest of England. It's a very beautiful, quite remote. It's about sort of 6-hour drive from London, which is not that far in American terms, I know, but in the UK that's pretty far. So like you could cover most of the country in that time. So very different. And she sort of agrees to move to the house because he tells her he's kind of bought it at auction and she's never seen it, but she just sort of goes along with it because it's surprisingly cheap and they need a change. And as soon as they get there, she has this immediate feeling that she's been to this house before, but she can't think how that could have been or why. And she, as far as she knows, she's never been to this part of the country at all. And then strange things start to happen. They're having some work done on the house and the builders are really hostile. One of them has a horrible accident. Start finding weird objects in the walls of the house and in the basement. Sort of as the book is kind of designed in four parts. And each part ends with a huge twist that kind of turns everything on your head as to who knew what.
Yeah. I know. I want to talk more about the witchcraft, but I did love the mechanics of the book, the idea that, because it's written in first person from four different people.
Yeah.
So I love that, because one of the things I love about writing in first person and reading first person books is you only know what your narrator is telling you. Mm-hmm. Right. But you get to do that, but then you still get that intimacy of first person, but you get to see a much bigger piece of the picture. So I really thought that was an interesting way to approach it.
I'm always, one thing I really love about starting a new book is like figuring out how's it going to work? How's it going to be structured? How's the viewpoint going to work? And I wanted to do something a bit different with this one where the viewpoints are in big chunks. So you get the first quarter of the book is from the wife's point of view. Then it shifts very abruptly into her husband's point of view and everything's different. And then we go back into the past to the point of view of the previous owner of the house, a woman who was rumored to be a witch and went to prison for a triple murder. That's when all the witchcraft comes in. And she has connections to the couple that are very sort of murky and twisty. And then we go back to the wife's point of view. And then at the very end, there's one extra little point of view, which is just a few pages, which is something that's a technique I love to do to just add a little twist at the end.
Yeah, I definitely don't want to spoil that. But I really appreciated that little end cap there. That was was a lovely little surprise at the end. So one thing I do think is really interesting about this book, because I mean, I do talk to a lot of like paranormal fiction writers, and I mean, because we mostly talk about witchcraft on the show or writing about witchcraft. So I do love that this book is writing about witchcraft, is like actual people who, you know, profess currently to be witches. It's that kind, it's this very reality based kind of witchcraft.
Yeah.
There's no like glowing orbs and all that kind of stuff. It's just really like she's an herbalist and there's some, you know, like folk magic charms and things like that.
Yeah, she's very keen to sort of say that she's not a witch, but she's kind of like does believe a bit more than she admits to.
Yeah. And like you said, tarot cards play a point.
Yeah. And then when she gets accused of this murder, it's kind of spun as like a Satanist crime. So she gets a long prison sentence. And so she's treated very harshly by the media and by the courts because they see her as a witch.
Yeah, because there's this overlay, I guess, on it with the timing and all of that stuff. Yeah. So what was the research like for you? I assume you are not a practicing witch. You do not practice witchcraft yourself.
I dabble.
Okay. Oh, well, good. Okay. Well, then we have other things to talk about too. Excellent.
Well, I learned to read the tarot in lockdown, and my friend and I went on a random trip to Glastonbury, if you know where that is.
Yeah.
It's a town in the southwest of England. It's not in Cornwall, but it's kind of on the way to it. It's famous for the festival, but we didn't go to the festival. We just went to stay in the town. It's this really fascinating place where people just very openly in the street will chat to you about the occult. And there's just wall-to-wall crystal shops, aromatherapy shops, you know, tarot bookshops, occult bookshops, tantric shops, just everything. So I picked up a pack of cards and I kind of taught myself to read them. And I think I'm quite good at it, actually, because it's about telling a story, which I enjoy. So I do that. I'm quite into like marking the seasons as well. So I suppose a little bit of astrology. I'm not a huge astrology person. I have a lot of friends who are very into it. But I like to do things that sort of mark the turning of the seasons and feast days, solstice and so on.
So there, I guess in the book, there is some discussion of, one of the characters is an herbalist, I would say, is how I would describe them, or a healer. And so what was the research like for that for you? Like, what did you dig into?
So it was a great excuse to go to Cornwall. So I went down for a couple of days and drove around and looked at that part of Cornwall is has a very long tradition of folklore and magic. So I sort of drove around and looked at stone circles and holy wells and things. And I read a whole lot about, so all of the herbal healing in the book, I researched all of that. And as far as I know, that's all accurate. Mm-hmm. So, but there are a lot of herbs that are very potent and actually can do a huge amount, but it can also be very toxic, which is a kind of theme I keep returning to, is that the same thing can be a poison or a cure, depending on how you use it and who takes it.
Yeah, I like that she kind of focused. I mean, there's, she says that many times, you know, it's, it's, this would be fine as a dose for an adult, but it would kill a child, you know, that kind of thing. Like, I appreciated that in the book. And I love that. I think I can tell this part without spoiling anything. There's a doctor when we're in the past who is, who doesn't like shun her, just says, you know, be careful kind of thing. So even like in this past experiment, there was still some appreciation that that could be of value, I guess.
Yeah. And her, her grandmother was a sort of noted healing woman and quite ruthless as well. And I think that's what I like about witchcraft, is that it just taps into this very feminine history. And it's a very feminine way of looking at the world. And it was something that gave women power, was to be able to heal themselves through plants and grow their own plants. And in many ways, sort of modern medicine has shut people out of that and disenfranchised people from their own health. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the other things I like about the approach to witchcraft and the occult in the book is that it's not 100% incidental, because part of the story hinges on, you know, part of the mechanics of the story is because this, because of her family and what it was like. But it's very much like, oh, these people just exist and they're here's a story about them, rather than this, rather than it, I guess, completely turning on the fact that there are witches involved. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So she's just trying to help people, really. And if people come to her for help, she will help them if she thinks they deserve it. Sometimes she won't help them, depending on what they're asking for.
Yeah.
But then it's, she sort of finds that people turn on her a little bit in the village, because she knows things about them. She's the kind of repository of all their secrets and their medical problems.
Yeah. Which I thought was really, I just thought that was handled really differently in the book. It's like that there's an appreciation and a fear of her.
Yeah.
Yeah. And especially of her grandmother too.
Yeah, she's a powerful woman. She's not married. She's, I think, 30 at this point. This is in the 80s. So people kind of think like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah. Why? And she's beautiful too.
Yeah. So. Yeah. She's beautiful and people see her as a threat. And she's quite outspoken as well. She can't really see anything that she disagrees with without kind of wading right in and trying to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I thought, you know, you know, she has an occult view on the world, like the things that happen don't happen because of her occult view on the world. They happen because of her personality and what she's willing to allow or are willing to defend, I guess.
Yeah. It's just perhaps her sort of not dealing with things in the best possible way and like making them work. Trying to constantly shape the world, I think, to her will, being frustrated when people don't take her seriously because she's just a young woman. She didn't get the chance to go to university. She didn't get to go to medical school or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I really enjoyed her character a lot. I thought she was incredibly well written. So as far as like this, like kind of the occult in your books, does it show up in other stories, or is this really the first time you stepped out on that limb?
I think this is the first time, but I think, so I grew up in Ireland and my first series of books was all set in Ireland, and a lot of people there do believe in the otherworldly, in folklore. So people, for example, if there's a ring of trees in the middle of a farming field, people would call that a fairy field, and a fairy ring, and they wouldn't cut it down, even though there's also just a really strong belief still in, I suppose, folklore and folk medicine as well. It's still quite just generally old wives' tales and things like that are quite widely believed. So probably some of those books probably look at it a little bit. So I also make use of things like standing stones and stone circles, which are, there's quite a lot of those where I grew up as well. Just the ancient world is very present still.
And I do wonder, like, I think about that as like writing, you know, I think writers all write from a sense of place, even if not consciously, mm-hmm. you know, and do you think we all kind of have, we, you know, it's not that, you know, write what you know, because I mean, we all write books that in places, you know, that we don't live or whatever. But I do wonder how much that, you know, what we grow up with, what, you know, where we travel, where that all kind of filters into the book. So if you kind of live in a place, like you said, where the ancient world is really present, would that make it more likely to, you know, obviously it's going to, you're going to be more likely to have an interest in it because you see it all the time, or maybe you become blind to it. I don't know.
Very normal when I grew up that even though I grew up in a religious environment, but at the same time that coexisted with quite a quite wide belief in banshees, fairies, mm-hmm. you know, things like that, just very superstitious, I suppose, culture I grew up in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you think now that you've written this book that these elements might show up in future projects, or is this kind of...
Well, it's not a movie. I've written anything subsequently about it. I'm definitely really fascinated by the tarot, so I'm going to keep learning about that, and maybe that might pop up, or maybe there's a way to sort of write a novel about the tarot somehow.
Yeah. The author and the name of the book has completely escaped me, but you saying that made me think of a novel that was written basically by, you know, the pulling a card.
Mm-hmm.
And the card shows up in the margins.
Yeah.
Of the page, and I'll have to look it up.
And
leave it in the show notes or something, but... Yeah, it was just, I've always thought that's really interesting. And I have talked to other writers who, like, sometimes, especially if they are discovery writers or pantsers or writing into the dark, whatever term you prefer as a writer, that when they get stuck, sometimes they'll go to tarot to, like, get an idea or something. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. I'm interested in how many women my age in the UK now are super into the occult. So mm-hmm. interested in that phenomenon. Like, why are people so suddenly interested in tarot? Astrology is so huge at the minute as well.
Yeah.
Just, why is that? Is it about trying to get some control back over things that you can't control?
Yeah. It's funny. Your book is the first fiction book I've read that specifically mentions the pandemic and COVID.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. I mean, I think we'll see more of them, obviously, but it was just interesting that it's like, oh no, this is now in fiction to you.
Yeah. So I think when it was happening, I know there was some debate about, you know, are there going to be loads and loads of pandemic novels? I can only think of one actually, which is called 56 Days. And it's by an Irish writer called Catherine mm-hmm. Ryan Howard. It's actually, it's very, very good. And it's about a couple who locked down together and they don't know each other that well. And we know that by the end of it, one of them is dead, but you don't know which one or why. And thought that was very clever.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't seen that many, not as many as we would have thought. I think there's been a sort of collective agreement that all of our books are now set in 2019. Or 2022.
Yeah.
So yeah. I wanted to kind of refer to it in this book. Like, it's not about COVID by any means. It's more just sort of, that's why they moved to the countryside. And that's mm-hmm. why the wife, Helen, is so, she has taken her eye off the ball and hasn't mm-hmm. quite worked out what's going on with this house.
Yeah.
Because she, kind of burnt out and suffering and blames herself for things that have happened.
Yeah. No. And I thought that was, I thought it was like, it was, like you said, it's mentioned, it's not about COVID. It's really just, here's another thing that fed into why this happened kind of thing.
It's actually quite hard to write about because I published another book this year, which was like a literary book club novel. And it follows a family over 20 years. And I do write about COVID a lot more in that, but the whole time I was writing it, things just kept changing. So
mm-hmm.
we'd write about having to have your temperature taken, for example, and then 2 months later, that was completely obsolete. So I had to take it out.
Yeah.
Everything has changed so rapidly.
Yeah. It's hard to write in the midst of it. I mean, I have a group of people that I talk with weekly that are writers. Sometimes we talk about writing. Sometimes we talk about other things. But during COVID, one of the conversations that we kept having was, we don't know yet what this is going to look like on the other side. So it's hard to write. Like mm-hmm. you could write a book now, like you said, like you have to get your temperature taken when you go to the airport. Well, that, like you said, that changed. And then that you had to have, you know, like a cleared health record to travel to another country or all those things. And those things have already changed. And one of the women in the group compared it to like writing before and after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you wrote a book like in the middle of that period of kind of adjusting and had somebody in the airport, like it would have all been wrong in 6 months because things changed so fast right after that too. So
yeah, and because books are generally published so far ahead that mm-hmm. that's probably what we haven't seen. That's one reason I think we haven't seen a lot of it, but also I think people just don't want to dwell on that weird time yeah. either.
Well, and I think about there's not, I mean, there are books written now that mention the 1918 pandemic, but if mm-hmm. you go back and look at literature at that time, they also didn't write a lot about it at the time.
No, yet. There's hardly anything about it, is there? It's quite remarkable, actually. I haven't ever read one book that even mentioned it, I think, and that was in passing. It's cool. Mm-hmm. Cool comfort from.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I do think it's probably a little bit, like you said, like we don't really want to dwell on it. And there's just like this collective agreement to amnesia to just kind of get back to some baseline of normal, even if that's really not the normal before.
Yeah, definitely. Here it's like nothing has changed really.
Yeah.
Like it happened. So.
Yeah. So for you, like when you were researching the stuff for the book, like what's your methodology? Like, are you a crack the books, go to the library person, or did you do like a lot of Googling, or like how do you approach research on those topics? I guess any topics for, you know, new research.
Bit of both. I have a bit of a bad habit of buying books about things and then just somehow believing I'll absorb the information without actually reading the book. Tend to do that a lot. I suppose I sort of start by reading quite widely. So I read a couple of books about witchcraft and Cornwall in particular, modern witches. And then I will sort of research specific things to see whether I've got it right. So like researching all the herbs, like what particular type of herbs you might give mm-hmm. to someone suffering with something in particular. And so I looked into all of that quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I keep reminding myself what things were like in the 80s as well. What were things like in 1987?
Yeah. Well, I always think now, like, especially writing genre fiction that has like a thriller or mystery element, like so much of like golden age mystery and thriller, like the plots could have been completely destroyed by the existence of a cell phone.
Yeah.
So it's like very different to write those things. Like you have to kind of like disable people in a little bit with their technology to get them into a position where you can kind of have those things happen where you're like, oh, this would just have been fixed by a phone call or an email, you know?
What's interesting actually is that in Cornwall, there are still huge parts of Cornwall where you don't have any phone reception.
Right. Which I thought actually played really well.
It's actually super annoying because everywhere you go, any beauty spot, you usually have to pay for parking.
Mm-hmm.
And they make you pay on an app now and there's no reception. So like, what are you supposed to do? It's really, really, really stupid and annoying. And constant point of anger for people.
Yeah.
Yes, it's quite surprising actually how often you would be in places and there'd just be no reception at all.
I don't know, Cornwall's one. I have been to the UK, but I have not been to Cornwall. And it's one of those places I'd really like to go and just
very beautiful. Yeah. It's a really special place. It can be quite overrun with tourists in the summer. Yeah. But
so summer, you're telling me summer's not the time to go.
Well, I went last year in June. It wasn't quite like school holiday summer, but it was accidentally went on a bank holiday week. So it was still fairly busy, but you can get away from it. The crowds quite easily too.
Parking, well, I imagine like any place like that, there's places that are definitely more tourist traps and places that are more off the beaten track kind of thing.
Yeah. And then the weather is also very unreliable. So you could have, if you have nice weather, it's like one of the most beautiful places in the world, but it could quite easily be raining and windy the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, like here I'm in California and I'm in San Jose where it's, you know, usually like sunny and 80, you know, like, but 20 minute mm-hmm. drive, you're on the coast and it can be foggy and 50 degrees. So,
yeah. Where was I? Yeah, I was there one time to the coast, again in June. It was the rest of the country was really hot. So, and then somehow where I was like 19 degrees and raining. I didn't get a coat. Whereas it was the rest of the country was just blazing sun. So it was like this weird little microclimate.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like that. And when I think about places like Cornwall and even like, you know, the Pacific Northwest, there's they have, because of the, I guess, the stereotypical weather and all of those kind of things, that it kind of gives them an otherworldliness, just the, the weather and how different they are than the rest of the country. And so.
Yeah. And I think writers are also quite guilty. I know I am, of using the weather to really ratchet up tension. So in this book, there was a storm at the end and people, you know, the roads are closed and things, which is quite plausible and does happen increasingly, like especially on the coast, roads get flooded and trees come down. And you can't always get help easily. You can't get the police, you can't get the ambulance out. But it's something we use a lot. So either it's too hot or it's snowing or there's a storm or just something. Something extra like this, you know, they're having no cell phone reception, just another kind of extra problem like that.
Yeah. But I always think of like in writing that sometimes the weather or the place or their own character. You know, they just have their own role to play in the story. And I have a friend who I've interviewed for the show, AJ Scuderi, who writes, is currently writing a series that is kind of like the apocalypse happening in slow motion. Like each book has one of the, is about one of the things that's happening now, just kind of ratcheted up. Like one of them is about the weather and it's about tornadoes in like the southern U.S. and how much worse they've gotten in the last few years. But, yeah, I mean, you know, ratchet it up to 11 because it's a eco thriller. So.
Yeah, but you already have the terrible wildfires in California and the mudslides and everything. And I think people have kind of forgotten because it happened right before COVID, but like February 2020 here, we had really terrible floods all across the UK and it was, it was devastating. And then we just kind of forgot all about that because
everything else happened right after it. Yeah. No, it was kind of true here. We had a couple of weird things happen, like right before, you know, things kind of, we never locked down to the extent the UK did. But we lived in Nashville in Tennessee for years. And I think literally like on March 1st, they had like a tornado hit downtown Nashville and a couple of people were killed. You know, it just kind of devastated this whole area of town. And then COVID happened and it was like, okay, but, you know. I mean, obviously, if you're there, you remember a bit, but nobody else really thought about it because everything else was going on. So,
yeah, I'm going to have Halifax, Nova Scotia in like less than a month, and it's half on fire, half flooded. I think even to see whether it recovers in time.
Yeah, hopefully, you're not landing in the middle of a fiery flood. That would not be. Why are you going to Halifax? Or is that? I mean, you don't have to answer this, so we can cut it out.
No, my partner's from, not from Nova Scotia, but from New Brunswick. So we're going for a family wedding and we're going to travel.
Fun. Yeah.
And then through sort of Maine and Boston, down to New York. So very excited. I've never been to New England. So looking forward to that. And hoping it's going to be very sort of Stephen King country. It's actually a hugely literary part of the world. I hadn't realized. And we don't have time to go everywhere, sadly. Yeah. But we're going to go to Prince Edward Island because I'm a big Gables fan. But we could also go to Louisa May Alcott's house, I think, is it in that area. Herman Melville, Nathaniel Hawthorne, just a lot of stuff to see. So,
there's a lot. Yeah, I've been to of those. I've been to the Nathaniel Hawthorne house, and it's pretty cool. I really like to go to the places that we have preserved for writers, like writers' houses and things like that, painters and things too. But writers really fascinate me to look at, like, especially if they have them set up like they lived there. You know, that's not always the case, but if they have I went years and years ago, it's probably been 25 years, to Jack London's house, which is actually close to where I live now. And it's, when you walk in, you can, like, it's almost like with all of the stuff that's there, you can see their brain, like, which I really like, and how they worked and like what their desk looks like. And, you know, I just am fascinated by all of that.
And I've been to, I live in London, kind of not far from Bloomsbury. So Charles Dickens' house is really near me. So I've been there quite a few times and you can see his desk. And I've been to Dylan Thomas's writing shed in Wales. That was really interesting. I've never been to Jane Austen's house somehow, despite being a massive Jane Austen fan. But I've been to the Bronte's house as well. And you can see their possessions and their desks and things. I've been to Dev Cottage. Is that what I mean? But where the Wordsworth lived. And it's amazing because it's absolutely tiny. And you get a real sense of, actually, they were not rich. They had loads of kids. They had loads of people coming to live with them all the time. Like Coleridge was always coming to stay. And Dorothy Wordsworth lived with them too, and it's just an absolutely tiny house and so dark and low ceilinged. So
it's really interesting. Like, how did you have all these people here and not want to murder each other?
They weren't wealthy, and there's just that's very obvious.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things about Jack London's house that surprised me, because I imagined him as quite wealthy, right? Just because of the time he was writing and all the traveling he did. But the house is small and tight. Like, everything is so tight compared to like a modern built house. Like, the rooms are really small and the hallways are small. Yeah, and everything is just, his house also looks like the Victorian Albert, like a Victorian yard sale. Like, it's just crammed with stuff. Really? Yeah, okay.
One day somebody might want to look at your writing space.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to me. And because I think my sister is an artist, and she kind of got me obsessed with this because she loves to go to artist houses and like see the light in their studio and all of that kind of stuff. And I was like, I bet those things exist for writers too. And I think they do. I think you do see some of who they are and how they wrote in those spaces.
I actually went to Agatha Christie's house as well, I just remembered, which is also down, it's not in Cornwall, but it's in Devon, so kind of down that way. And it's huge. Like, she was very rich.
Yeah, I was gonna say she was making bank.
Yeah, loads of grounds as well, so even nowadays it's actually quite hard to get to. It's very secluded, so she had all this space, she could just shut people out. Yeah, it's really, she actually never wrote at this house, I don't think. It's just like where she went to be alone, but it's very beautiful.
Yeah, the other one I've been to is Hemingway's house in the Keys, which he didn't live there very long. I mean, you know,
I went there in my teens briefly.
Yeah, but it is with all of the polydactyl cats. And
yeah, I thought it was beautiful, Key West. I love it.
Yeah, I always joke that if someone told me I had to live in Florida, I would probably want to pick Key West, but I'm also terrified of hurricanes, so it'd be really hard to do that. Cool. Yeah. Now you have Austin's house on your list, obviously. Is there someone you'd really like to see their house? Or their desk, maybe even just their desk.
I'm pretty obsessed with Sylvia Plath. And she did die in a flat not far from here, I know. But I don't, as far as I know, there's no house you can visit where she lived. Yeah, I'd love to see any of her. I know that actually a lot of her property is for sale. You can generally buy it at auction and things. Yeah. So I've been to the house where Ted Hughes lived. So, and if you're a grave up in Yorkshire, it's also very beautiful. But yeah, I'd love to see somewhere that she has space for her.
That's funny. This is the second time. I mean, it's morning for me. For folks listening, we're about 10 hours difference right now, or eight or nine hours difference. Yeah. And, Sylvia Plath has already come up today for me, which is funny.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. A writer friend of mine messaged me this morning with a TikTok, basically, you know, I can't think of the word I want, but basically just kind of redeeming Sylvia Plath. Cause I think she gets here to some extent, I don't know how true it is there, but here occasionally, she kind of gets dismissed with things teenage girls like.
Yeah, and she was a colossal talent, and you know, she was dead by the time she was 30, so
and I just feel like she's a little underrated because of that. Yeah. I think people tend to focus on the suicide and not the writing.
It was very sad. She was just chronically depressed from her teens, really, and she tried to kill herself at 20, so it wasn't a new thing, sadly, and she just was kind of failed by the medicine at the time. Just really, really tragic loss. And
today apparently is Sylvia Plath Day.
Maybe it was her birthday.
I don't know.
I believe she died in February, so not bad.
It's funny to me when those things happen, when you get those weird little synchronicities.
To go back to the occult, do you believe in things like that, like manifesting and kind of signs?
I consider myself a practitioner. And I do think that, you know, occasionally we get nudges of some sort, but sometimes a crow is just a crow, you know? Like.
Yeah. I do. I think signs are just like your brain picking up on certain things and noticing. But I do believe there's something in manifestation. It's just something to do with reattuning. Actually, there is quite a lot of scientific evidence that it does work, not in the way that people necessarily think it works, but just in helping you to imagine things as being true and spotting opportunities and not like doing yourself out of opportunities that might come your way.
I mean, you have to be receptive to things going the way you want them to be.
Also, today apparently Lionsgate Day.
Right. Today is the light day.
So today is a big day for manifesting, apparently, because they're my app tells me anyway.
Yeah, it's funny. This is the first year I've seen people who I would not think of as like kind of new age astrologer people really talking about it. And I have this personal gnosis, I guess, about, you know, I think everything was made up at some point, right? Yeah. So, you know, how long does something have to be? Because somebody was saying, oh, this was just something, you know, new agey people made up in the 80s. And I'm like, well, you know, Wiccan Gardnerian Wiccans were made up in the 50s. So like, you know, how long does it have to be made up for it to not, you know, for it to be meaningful to people? Like, how much energy do we put into a thing before it actually is a thing?
So. Yeah. And I actually, that's what I mean. Like there is, it is penetrating all parts of society now. It's not just people that are very woo woo now. It's a lot of people believe this or talk about it, even if they don't fully believe it.
Right.
But there's going to be something in it. Like we do, certainly certain types of times of the year do have like different energy, don't they? Like in my world in publishing, nothing will happen in August. And then as soon as we get back in September, everything's going to start happening and moving and shifting. So there's things like that I believe in.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, just based on like where you live, we know that ancient people also thought the times of years were important for some reason because they built monuments to it. So
yeah.
It's like it's not a new thing for our brains to work that way.
Oh no, absolutely not. Like the Celts, so I'm from Ireland, the Celts had a very strong belief in the kind of waxing and waning of the year and the fire beasts at certain times. Yeah. And if you've read Thunder, you'll know more about those.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Well, we do try to keep it to an hour, although I'm not always great about that. But I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of plug what you've got coming up. Like I said, this will come out in early November. And, you know, where, if you want people to find you, all that good stuff. And then we'll do our little game of chance question at the end.
So my main book at the moment is Let Me In. So it's the story of a young couple moving to a fixer-upper in the countryside and how that goes horribly wrong and how they both have connections to this house that they haven't revealed or weren't aware of. And the house used to belong to a triple murderer who was also supposed to be a witch. So the house has lots of kind of spooky things in it, spooky energies. The villagers are really hostile. And just I designed it so that it would have several huge twists within the book that kind of turn everything on its head. So that was fun for me to write, hopefully fun to read. That's my main thing. And then I'm working on my next one is kind of done, actually. It's another thriller about a group of friends who go to an island for a 40th birthday party, and they play the game Two Truths and a Lie, and somebody puts an extra truth into the box which says that they're all going to die on this island, and then things start to unravel pretty rapidly. People can find me, I'm on Instagram at Claire McGowan Writer, on Twitter at Inkstains Claire, if Twitter is still going. Generally pretty findable online. Always love to hear from people. My books are sort of mostly available digitally because I'm published by Amazon, one of Amazon's publishing imprints. So Kindle is probably the best place to find the books.
Awesome. Okay. And all that will be in the show notes for people so they can get to it easily. We'll put links to the book. So our last question is, like I said, a little bit of a game of chance. And I joke that it's that because I'm a Scorpio, that I don't know how to do small talk, that we always want to get, you know, to the deep, dark things as quickly as possible. So I'm going to roll a die. And depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I roll a 6, you get to pick which one you want. And because this game only has the rule that I'm rolling a die, you can say skip and we'll do a different one.
Okay.
So 4, politics. You down for politics?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, politics is probably quite different in where I am than where you are.
Yeah. But kind of, I guess, a bigger question, like, you know, some writers really treat politics like a third rail, like in their public persona or even in their books, not to alienate readers. So what is your take on politics in your public life, in your books?
I'm fairly open about my own politics, I would say. But I try in my books to understand other points of view, because that's just what I try and do about every issue, I suppose, is try and like get into the mindsets of people that see things differently. So I'm writing another book at the minute on spec, to, you know, not under contract, but I'm going to try and sell it when I'm done, which is very political. It's all about women's rights, reproductive rights. And that feels like way into a very thorny area, but it feels hugely important to me to do that. So.
Yeah. And timely.
Yeah. So that will be probably the most political thing. And I also wrote a lot of books set in Northern Ireland where I grew up. So those are kind of quite political as well, dealing with the legacy of the past and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you had like any blowback or weird things happen when you've been forward about your own personal beliefs?
Well, I actually had a weird email a couple of weeks ago from somebody who'd read my last book, not Let Me In, the one before, which is about a mother on maternity leave who can't sleep and is sort of slowly losing her mind and teams up with her neighbor to, who also can't sleep, to solve what they think is a crime. It was a man who said, "I was enjoying this until I realized that you hate stay-at-home mothers and I threw your book in the bin." And then he told me about how his wife had absolutely loved being a stay-at-home mother. And, you know, she was very bright, but she'd still love this. I thought that was quite funny because there's nothing that's not in the book. You know, it's just she's on maternity leave and she's worried that her job won't be there when she comes back, which is not to say that she doesn't want to be a stay-at-home mother. She just can't afford to be because she lives in London. So I thought that was quite interesting. Wow. People do get annoyed at things that aren't even there. Like that wasn't even an intention.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, I don't know. I mean, I think that's one of the things about writing fiction. I mean, writing nonfiction, I think too, but more so in fiction, is that every single person who reads it reads their own story. Like, and they're just going to bring whatever their lens is to that. And at that point, as a writer, you have no control.
Yeah. And they're just triggered by stuff that maybe isn't even there. Like, you know, there's nothing in my book about being a stay-at-home mother. She's not a stay-at-home mother. She's on maternity leave. Sometimes she wishes she could stay at home and they just can't afford it. So just, it's interesting that that was what he took
out. That was his takeaway from it. Well, I don't know. I always think when people say, you know, "Oh, I, you know, gave your book away or threw it away," I was like, "Well, thanks for your book, for buying my book."
Yeah. It's like, you know, violent response. Just like throw it in the bin, isn't it? And also it's like, were you reading it in paperback? Because it's mostly digital. So threw your Kindle in it. Yeah, it's just funny.
Yeah, hopefully you didn't throw your whole Kindle in the bin over that.
But I'm always surprised by the messages people will send you. Like, it's as if they don't get that you're going to read it. Like, people send some very, very rude messages sometimes. And if I'm having a bad day, I'll just write back and be like, "What? Why have you sent me this? This is incredibly rude." And they're always quite shocked. Like, "Oh, I didn't think you'd read it." Like, okay, well, who's going to read it? I don't have a team of assistants. You know,
yeah.
If you send me an email, I will get it and read it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit off the topic of politics, but, you know, like I said, this game has no rules. I am surprised at the false sense of anonymity people have in email. Like, you know, your email address is on this.
Yeah, and you've given me a full name, but you've just been... I get quite a lot of emails with people, usually from men, I have to say, where they're like, "Oh, I liked your book. I really liked your book. It's really good. But here's like a minor plot hole that I think I found." And they're saying, "What am I going to say to that? Like, thank you for finding this, and you're wrong anyway." So
yeah,
find it really interesting mindset. I guess I just want attention, so I usually just don't reply if I think it's rude.
I do find that interesting, and I've had more. I think I do wonder a little bit. So, you know, my friend AJ, he writes thrillers, like, she does get a lot of those comments, like on social media and in reviews about, "Well, you didn't know blah, 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 blah." And she's like, "Well, you're wrong, because I researched that." But also, like, this idea that, you know, once the book is out in the world, there's no fixing it. I mean, thanks for letting me know if it really is wrong, but I can't do anything about it at this point.
Yeah, well, somebody sent me an email. This was a woman, actually, just to be fair, a couple of weeks ago, who'd read my second book, which was published 10 years ago. And she was like, "I have a list of questions." And these questions were obviously like, "Here are some mistakes I think you've made." And again, I just didn't replied to that because I was like, I don't remember anything about that book. Like, you're asking me what happened to this cat. I have no memory of there being a cat in this book. I've written like 20 books since then. To me, that's like separate to myself. I don't remember. Yeah. I barely even remember what's in it, let alone writing it.
Yeah. And do you think that is one of the things that is a weird disconnect between readers and writers? Is like, once we've finished a project, it's kind of goes in a mental box. And then you write the new thing. And I think, you know, as a reader, we're so absorbed. Like having read your book recently, having read Let Me In recently, I probably have a sharper mental map of the details than you do, just because I was completely immersed in it for 2 days.
Yeah. And so, I haven't read it for like a year now, probably.
So. Right. Yeah. So I think that to me is always interesting. Like the different experiences of writing and reading a book, like how different they are. Like, I'm obsessed with it for a year, 2 years, or 3 years, or however long to take to read it, to write it. And then it's just gone.
Yeah. And it's healthy though. If you were still obsessing over, maybe I did make a mistake in my second book 10 years ago, that would be just be impossible. You'd go mad.
Yeah. And I think that's also how you get stuck a little bit. Or one of the ways you can get stuck is obsessing over things that are already out there.
Yeah, and like we talked a little bit about this at the start, that's one way that I'm able to write a whole book is I never look back. When I'm writing, I don't delete, write a thing or edit anything. It just goes straight through and then I go back and fix it.
Yeah.
Which can be sometimes the one I'm currently editing, I seem to have written half in the past tense and half in the present tense, which is incredibly annoying. So I obviously couldn't decide what I was going to do it in. So now I'm trying to line by line fix it.
I feel like I've read more books recently written in present tense. And I don't know if it's just kind of trendy.
I don't like it most of the time, so I don't know why I decided to do this one in the present, but it just seems to work. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does work in some stories, and there is something about like thriller and crime genres, especially, that make it very present in the first tense, like, you know, in present tense and first person.
Yeah.
But I think it's hard to write.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's just, I always just go by instinct in these things, like, is it the first person, third, past or present?
Yeah.
Who's you are getting, and just sort of operate by instinct.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Claire, thank you so much for being on the show and for writing this excellent book that I hope people will go check out. I'm looking forward to what's next.
Great. It's so nice to chat to you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye then.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Sue Fertal edits our transcripts, which are available with all of our previous episodes at witchlitpod.com. You can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.